And good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard Friday. My name is Russ Simmons, and since I'm sitting here in the host chair today, that means it's movie day here on Central Standard Friday. We're going to be talking about some of the films that have come out over the last month or so and are still playing in Kansas City theaters. And we'll also be talking about your pet peeves. We wanted to send it out there and ask you to contact us and let us know what are your pet peeves when you're in the theater. Sometimes, of course, cell phones come to mind or projection or whatever issues that you have. What is it that bothers you when you go to the theater? You can join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888. You can send us an email to centralstandard@kcur.org. And we're also reading your tweets at KCURCST. So be sure and contact us. Once again, this is Russ Simmons, and today I'm joined by...
I'm Eric Moline, a movie critic for ScenesDealers.com, Kansas First News, and the Lawrence Journal World.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas.
We're going to be talking about a lot of different films, but I thought it would be good for us to start out with one that opens up today that's getting a lot of buzz. It's a film thriller, a political thriller, set in 1979. It's called
Argo. A pretty solid thriller, by golly. And when he takes some license with the historical facts at the end, he really pumps up that suspense. It's one of the most entertaining films I've seen. And yet, you know, it is a Ben Affleck film because he has a flair for Hollywood kitschy stuff. Because all in that background of bringing a faux film crew into Tehran, you have this John Goodman spin and Alan Arkin spin on what filmmaking is all about and all of the schlocky posters and send-ups going on. Affleck loves that kind of thing. It's here in spades, some of the funniest, most entertaining parts of the movie. Now, I found Affleck curiously rather flat in his own impersonation as Mr. Mendez, who leads this operation. But nonetheless, across the board, it is enormously entertaining. And you know what? It's informative. Who knew about President Carter? I don't know if I should say any more, but that was a revelation for me, and I lived through that time.
Right.
I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 4 stars.
Eric?
I think that's pretty generous. There's a lot of hype about this film, and my job here today is to bring that down, I feel, because everybody's talking about this as a big Oscar Best Picture front runner. I don't see that. I think, as John said, it's a very efficient, suspenseful thriller. And let's just leave it at that, just because it's about a historical topic, the Iran hostage crisis in 1980, and how these CIA people smuggled, essentially, these 6 Americans who were hiding out at the Canadian embassy's personal residence. Just because it's about that, I don't really think it delves into that very much. I think it really exists on the one dimension, and that is just as a thriller. It's scary to be here. How do we get them out? Look at this crazy way that they got them out. And it works. I give it a minor recommendation. I'll say maybe 3, I guess, out of 5. But I think that people are going a little bit gaga over this right now, a little bit early. And what I will say about Ben Affleck is that he's proven before with Amy Ryan in Gone Baby Gone and Jeremy Renner in The Town that he knows how to direct actors. I agree with John. He's done a terrific job of that here. But I will disagree and say that this is his best performance, I think, in a while because it's so low-key and muted. Yeah. I think he's really tamped down the cheese factor that I usually get from an Affleck performance in this movie. So it's a good movie, not a great one.
You know, I think the reason for the Oscar buzz is because this is just exactly the type of film that Oscar voters love.
Absolutely.
It's historical. It's serious. It's studio-driven. It's a studio-driven enterprise. It's well-produced. It's produced by an actor, George Clooney. It's directed by an actor, Ben Affleck.
Yes.
And if you go back historically and look at other Oscar winners, you see that this is a pattern that they love. They love to award those actors who make really good movies.
I'm wondering how or what percentage of audience members will come to it knowing anything about that period. Remember when Nightline came on and it was a day-by-day chronicling of the hostage crisis? I mean, it gripped the world for more than a year. Now, some of that comes through, but to come armed with that knowledge of that time and the tensions of that time, I think can feed into your viewing of the film in a positive way.
Yeah, there's a very quick prologue at the beginning of the film that kind of sets up the political situation, and I thought that it did a really good job. But then all of the subtleties of that are abandoned right away. We have clear-cut good guys and bad guys, and so I think a little bit more going into that would have made the film a little bit deeper. So as a thriller, I think it works.
Yeah, you know, it's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a solid movie.
Yep.
It's an entertaining movie.
Yep.
And as for by Hollywood standards, what are you asking for? You want to be entertained? You want to learn about a place of time in history that you didn't know about? One thing that I will give Affleck credit for is he does establish a sense of time and place.
Yep.
And he does keep a good pace to this film. And he handles the bouncing back and forth between areas really well.
And tones,
yeah. And it's got the Hollywood angle. That's the one more reason why I think Oscar is going to love this,
yeah.
Is because it's got that backstage Hollywood angle going on as well, that they're exposing some of the phoniness of Hollywood.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there's a great line in there where John Goodman says to Ben Affleck, he says, "So you're coming into Hollywood and you're pretending to make a fake movie and you're going to I'm paraphrasing here, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're coming in here and you're going to put on airs as like you're some big filmmaker and you're going to make a movie." And Ben Affleck goes, "Right." He says, "You'll fit right in."
Yeah.
And I kept thinking of Affleck's performance in the Superman film.
Hollywoodland.
In Hollywoodland, yeah. We have this kind of mix of Hollywood artifice and pathos,
mm-hmm.
And I think there's some of that here too.
Yeah, I'm gonna give it a 4. I think I liked it a mm-hmm. bit better than both of you. But John, you gave it a 3.5.
3.5.
You gave it a 3. I'm giving it a 4. So we'll average it out to a 3.5 for Argo, which is rated R. Let's talk about another film by a really terrific filmmaker, Paul Thomas Anderson, that came out back on the 21st. And I think we're going to get some varied reactions to this one. It's called The Master.
Yes. And so actually, it's a great segue into The Master from Argo, because The Master is the kind of movie that I think Oscar should be rewarding. This is a film that is deep. It works on so many thematic levels. It's got terrific multi-layered performances. It doesn't come right out and tell you exactly what it's about. It's kind of a mystery. And what's weird about it is that it's not set up like a mystery. It's a character-driven drama. So we have Joaquin Phoenix, a World War II vet who comes home. This guy is psychologically and physically damaged. He's got all kinds of problems. And he meets Lancaster Dodd, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is a leader of sorts. He says he's a thinker, a nuclear physicist, but above all, an inquisitive man just like you. And immediately, Phoenix is like, "I don't know who this guy is. But I'm kind of calling BS on him, but at the same time, I'm very drawn to him." And as you watch the film, there are so many great scenes that just stick out and stick with me and keep me wanting to come back and revisit them to see how my interpretation is going to change. This is not a takedown of Scientology, which a lot of the Lancaster Dodd character, an inspiration, was drawn from L. Ron Hubbard and Dianetics. But this is really a love story, if you will, about a guy who wants to control people and a guy who needs to be controlled, and how they resist each other and eventually come together. And it's this cyclical relationship that it seems like they are going to have forever. And it is beneficial to both of them, and it hurts both of them. And so in the end, it's not like there's one specific thing that you can draw out of this film and say it was about this. There's so many things, and having it take place in the 50s, 1952, and this era of confusion as people were coming back from the war, it just heightens the whole thing. Cinematography, art direction, acting especially, just top-notch stuff, but it doesn't have a catharsis. And so in the third act, when it's supposed to reach this big dramatic climax, I found myself sitting there going, "That was it?" And then it never left my thoughts after that. So I'm warning everybody, if you go see this film, you may feel like there's a lot of unresolved issues. And I think that's the point. So this kind of challenging material is the kind of stuff that I think Oscar really should be rewarding, instead of the surface value stuff that you get in Argo.
It's amazing how many things I agree with you about this film, Eric, but yet I hated it. Now, I realize I'm going against the grain of some consensus about this picture, and which puzzles me. I don't know if it's me or my instincts are wrong or whatever. But yes, it's about a lot of things. It's a mulligan stew of a movie, which ends up, in my view, being about nothing in particular. That's why I agree with your thing about there's no catharsis, there's not much of anything. What I loved about it is Amy Adams as Lancaster Dodd's wife. Boy, is she scary. Who knew she had that in her?
Yeah.
And what I hated most about it was Joaquin Phoenix. I mean, he's butting his head against the wall. He's falling into temper tantrums, fits, frenzies, fist fights. A thoroughly repellent character who lost me with any kind of sense of who is this guy. He's not just a mess. He's messy. And, you know, he can make love to a sand dune, which recurs a few times more than I could have wished. But it was annoying, annoying, annoying. Maybe it was supposed to be, in which case the film deserves more stars than there are in heaven. But yeah. It was simply annoying. As for Philip Seymour Hoffman, I never got it. I didn't feel any of the charisma everybody else was feeling. Okay, he can get a room full of women to strip naked. That scene still, like, what? So out of 4 stars, best I can do is 2.
I believe the scene you're talking about, though, I think that we're supposed to see that from Phoenix's point of view. So in my view, that scene didn't actually happen. That was how Phoenix was seeing it. It wasn't a room full of naked women, but rather this guy who, as you said earlier, was trying to make love to a sand dune and is still addicted to sex, is now thinking that all the ladies in the room are naked. So it is kind of a confounding film, and that's one of the reasons that I like it.
And how many stars, Eric, would you give it out of 5?
4.5.
One thing, if I may, about the music. What we saw in There Will Be Blood, a meandering soundtrack of ostinato patterns and rhythms. Atonal patches of sounds that, to me, drew away from the image rather than informed it, examined it, interrogated it. I love music in films. This, to me, was one of the worst aspects of it. It just did not mesh with the images as far as I was concerned.
I tend to agree with you on that. Johnny Greenwood's score was overbearing to me. However, I find myself a bit conflicted between the two of you because, I agree with both of you. And that makes this movie all the more interesting to talk about. It's one of those movies that really generates a lot of post-movie coffee talk because what's up there is so interesting and so riveting and so frustrating all at the same time. And that's what a great filmmaker, I think, like Paul Thomas Anderson will do to you. It's got an elliptical plot, which people don't like. People want to have the holes filled in. They want to know what this is really all about. And he's not about to give that to you. He wants you to do that yourself and do a little work and bring that to the movie yourself. I do disagree, John. I thought that Joaquin Phoenix's performance was brilliant. I think he has got to be the front runner for the Oscar. And it is a very showy performance, I'll give you that. But it's exactly the poor performance that they were looking
for.
Well,
I had the feeling that Anderson just turned him loose.
Yes.
Just go ahead and indulge yourself, whether or not it had really anything to do with the rest of the film or not.
My favorite performance is Philip Seymour Hoffman. So we're going around the table. We have such a difference of opinion on this. I think Hoffman was really warm and that his character, despite being somebody who may or may not believe everything he says, he believes in the search. And I think that he believes in people. And that warmness comes across. And I thought it was a really great subtle performance by Hoffman. And for me, that's the performance of the year that I've seen. So
interesting. Yeah, yeah. I do think that it wouldn't be unheard of to see both of those nominated for Best Actor against one another to see how that works out in the competition.
Yeah, I'd like to see Phoenix come up onto the platform to accept his Oscar and hit himself over the head with it.
I'm going to give it a 4. It's one of those movies that I think has so much humanity, and it, even though it's rambling and obscure, what could have been, I think, a masterpiece is simply a very good movie because of those flaws and lack of focus. But I will give it a 4 out of 5. And so I think between the three of us, you gave it a 4.5 and John gave it a 2. So and I gave it a 4. So we'll say 3.5. If we averaged it out between the three of us for The Master, and that is rated R. And it does earn that R rating, by the way.
It's also very funny, which we haven't mentioned. Very funny. There are some scenes in this that are very darkly funny, and that Paul Thomas Anderson kind of way.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday here on KCUR. Did you see The Master? We'd like to hear your opinion. 816-235-2888 or send us an email to centralstandard@kcur.org. And we're also reading your tweets at KCURCST. We want to hear your opinions as well. Take us to task or agree with us, whatever you want to do. And let us know about your pet peeves. Is there something that bothers you when you go to the theater? Give us a call and let us know what that might be as well. Let's move quickly to another film that opened back on September 28th. It's a really intriguing sci-fi time travel flick called Looper.
Yeah, Looper is directed by Rian Johnson, who is a great filmmaker who made his debut some years back with a high school film noir called Brick, followed that up with a European heist kind of caper, con man love story called The Brothers Bloom, and now he is combining genres again with Looper. And so basically what you have is time travel as an excuse to explore bigger things like the cycle of violence and taking responsibility for your actions. And the great thing about Looper, which stars Bruce Willis as Old Joe and Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Young Joe, who are the same person stuck in the same timeline, is that it does want to explore bigger themes. And I think the best kind of sci-fi movies are like that. If the movie was just about time travel and it was just about Old Joe coming back into time and Young Joe assigned by the mafia to kill him and not able to do that, and then it turned into some big chase movie, that would be one thing. But the film establishes a clear set of rules, whether you agree with the logic or not, because there's a lot of different kinds of time travel, is really besides the point. If you take the premise at its word and then you move forward, it really does turn into this great little character drama with Emily Blunt and her son. And all of a sudden, the movie just takes this right turn. And once you realize that the time travel only exists to serve the story, it's a lot easier to accept the fact that this film does slow down. So it's pretty action-packed. It's got a lot of great, interesting twists in it. And then it just kind of slows down and then it becomes a character drama. But wow, this does have an emotional punch, I felt. By the end of the film, I felt that all of the loose ends were tied up and that thematically it worked 100%. And the last thing I want to say about Looper is that there's a moment in this movie where I'm not going to say what it is, but it's a montage that takes us from Joseph Gordon-Levitt to Bruce Willis. And I almost applauded in my seat after that one sequence was done with, because this is why I go to the movies. I go to see something I've never seen before, something with you know, that must have taken huge amounts of chutzpah or whatever to do. I mean, that was just – it was one of those moments where, wow, I've never seen anything like that in a movie before. Congratulations. And I just think Looper is really one of the best sci-fi movies that we've seen in years.
Yeah, that montage is like hopscotching across a lapse of time.
Yeah.
It's so beautifully done. I was oddly reminded of Ang Lee's Ride with the Devil in terms of big action setup, and then it slows down to a pace involving human relationships and a child and parents. A lot of people didn't like that last third to a quarter of Ride with the Devil. I thought it was the heart of the film. Here, this is the heart of the film, because time travel paradoxes notwithstanding. And I think the movie goes gently on that sort of thing. We don't have our brain twisted up too much. It's the heart of what happens to these characters in the last part of the movie that left me very moved, suddenly realizing I was more interested in the characters than I was in time travel paradoxes. And that's a real switcheroo for me, because I love time travel stuff. So it surprised me, and agreeably so. I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 4.
And how many for you, Eric?
Oh, the same.
Okay. You know, I tend to agree with both of you. You know, time travel movies always have plot holes. The thing that makes Looper work is they fill those plot holes with clever details and artistic touches that really make it a very satisfying and entertaining movie. And you're right, when the characters finally do come together at the end, it's very, very satisfying in an emotional sense. And you don't get that from a lot of science fiction action films. But a thoughtful movie like this, which is thoughtful and action-packed, it makes it all the more satisfying when you now, see the final product.
In all fairness, I think it backs off from some of the paradoxes that it sets up. It takes the classic time travel paradox only just so far, but doesn't really deliver on it. It's too complicated to get into. But if you really want to bend your mind apart, read, there's several stories by Robert Heinlein where all of the characters turn out to be the same guy. Mm-hmm. By his bootstraps, things like that. So if you want to read a time travel story that delivers on the potential paradoxical setups, check those out. But fortunately, it's not here on the screen.
So yeah, I was just going to say also the great thing about this setup is that it allows us to all consider what we would say to our future selves. Right, it's like they have that scene in the diner where Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis are talking to each other.
And they ordered the same hamburgers.
Yeah. And they're the same guys. And the young one says to the old one, you know, tell me something. He's like, no, I don't really want to. You know, let's not do this. And you're just like, what? And it's this great moment because you vacillate between sympathies for these characters the entire time. First you're with Levitt, then you're with Willis, then you're back with Levitt, and these are not nice guys. But there is a maturity and a depth to the characters that eventually comes through, and it's surprising.
So we're giving it 3.5 around the board here?
Is this out of 5 or 4?
Out of 5.
I keep forgetting. Out of 5, I'm giving it a 4.
Going out of 5. Heavens, shame on me.
How many out of 5, guys?
4.
Yeah, 4 for me, too.
4 for me as well. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Looper, rated R, gets a 4 out of 5 stars.
Okay.
And we had a caller that wanted to chat a bit about The Master. Bob from Piper, welcome aboard.
Yeah, my wife and I saw that, and she really didn't care for it. I think there was an awful lot of symbolism in it, and which is fine with me. She's not much into symbolism. I agree with one critic that the room of women that seem to gradually lose their clothing, I think that was Phoenix's imagination. That's the way I took it anyway. And I also heard another critic about a week or so ago say that he did such a good job at playing a feral individual, and I thought that was really well put. By the time I saw it, I had to agree with it.
Bob, you talked about the symbolism of the movie. What symbolism did you see?
Well, it's hard to say. I'd almost have to see it again. I'm kind of thinking about doing that. The relationship between the two of them could have been taken so many different ways. I really think it was what one of you gentlemen said today, that the charismatic leader just had the desire to lead, and Phoenix kind of fell into the role of someone who desperately needed to be led. And to me, that's so symbolic of people who can so easily be led astray.
Well, talk about symbolism. I think, you know, when you said that thing about him being an animal, I think he is a feral animal in this movie. And Dodd, Hoffman's character, says right at the beginning, you know, we are more than stupid animals. But at the same time, I think he considers Freddie Quell, the Phoenix character, to be one of those animals and maybe his greatest challenge.
Well, why don't we pursue that? When Phoenix first meets him, it's aboard a yacht. So here are these animals cavorting about an expensive yacht. So there's a weird kind of American dream going on there.
Mm-hmm, that's a good take on that.
Thanks for your call, Bob. Really appreciate your input. You can join Bob by calling us at 816-235-2888, or again, you can send an email to centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us, KCURCST. We have other callers coming in, but in the meantime, I wanted us to cover a Tim Burton animated film called Frankenweenie.
Yeah, this is a spinoff, a short film that he made some time ago for Disney. I took a couple of two little kids, 12 years old, and enjoyed watching the movie. Some of the monsters that show up, and I'm not talking about the dog Sparky, but there are other monsters that show up who are pretty genuinely scary. Now, my problem with Frankenweenie, though, is that I think Tim Burton paints himself into a corner. Okay, we have young Victor Frankenstein. He resurrects his dog Sparky with electricity. Now the dog's alive. And then what? Where do you go from there? Where Burton chooses to go is to give us a whole circus carnival of crazy creatures, and he's having a lot of fun with that. But the plot doesn't seem to be doing anything. And there's something at the end that bothered me a lot, and I won't say in what exactly, but gosh, I hope I'm not going too far. But Sparky dies the second time, so what do you do now? And I think Burton really dug himself a hole in that sequence, which made the whole movie just kind of fall into tatters for me. In short, I think Frankenweenie is an exercise in self-indulgence, well-crafted, I think fun for the kids. But for me, if I can call myself an adult, I came out of it highly indifferent about what I've just seen. So out of five now, I'm just going to go 2.5.
I'd go for 3 on Frankenweenie, or maybe even 3.5. I mean, let's face it, this is not a plot-driven film. You know what I mean? As John said, a boy resurrects his dog, and then where do you go from there? Well, what Burton chooses to do is kind of make it an homage to all these classic Universal horror films.
That's the self-indulgent aspect.
Yeah, and for us as adults, that's the thing we can latch on to. But for the kids, I think they want to have this heartwarming ending, and I think that's what you end up getting at the end, which is also what you're referring
to. Did you like that ending?
I liked it just fine, but it was what it was. But I love the art direction and the way the film looked. It, as you said, very well crafted.
The animation is amazing.
Yeah. So we're averaging it out to 3 for Frankenweenie, rated PG. We want to hear your takes on these movies. Have you seen them? Let us know what you think by calling us at 816-235-2888 or emailing us or tweeting us at KCURCST. We're going to be talking more about your pet peeves as well. So give us a call and let us know, are there things that bother you in the theater? We want to hear your takes after this break. And welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM, and we're talking about the movies with my colleagues Eric Moline and John Tibbetts. We're covering some of the films that have come out over the last month or so. We're also talking about pet peeves. What bothers you when you go to the theater? And we're getting some feedback on that, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But before we jump into that, John, you had a comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, I was just listening to the note about Carmina Burana being performed here in Kansas City. It's a reckless, fun, kind of intoxicating piece of music, but it's also significant to know that it was a calling card for the Nazi Party in the 1930s. Mm. Karl Orff is one of the more infamous figures during that time. Not a Nazi, but boy, did he do some bad stuff at that time. And Carmina Burana was a popular favorite, so you might kind of bear that in mind.
Okay, that's good to know.
Probably not, but it's been whitewashed over the years.
I see. Okay. Well, want to go ahead and take a comment quickly from Suzanne, who's been waiting patiently on the phone, who wanted to talk about The Master. Welcome aboard, Suzanne.
Hi. Hello. It's actually Susan, but
excuse me.
That's okay. I wanted to ask a question, actually, about Joaquin Phoenix's performance in The Master. It's my understanding that the character has PTSD, and so I was just wondering if that accounted for the things that, you know, his character was going through, and I guess the qualities that John found annoying, and I was just wondering if that was why his character was doing those things. I haven't seen the movie, obviously.
But I found myself wondering more if it was Joaquin Phoenix who had the PTSD or whatever the LSMFT or whatever that acronym is.
You know, it's never actually explicitly said, though, in the movie.
No.
I think that it's kind of understood now because that kind of thing wasn't something that was diagnosed back then. Mm-hmm. But we do see him talking to the psychologist and he goes through some of those stages on his way out of the Army. I know that from what I've listened to in interviews and things like that, that Paul Thomas Anderson did give Joaquin Phoenix a lot of leeway with this character.
Absolutely.
And that one thing that Phoenix has is a problem with his back and his shoulder and a kind of a physical deformity that he's been living with,
right,
that he masks in all of his other characters.
But here it comes to the fore.
Well, in this one, he said, hey, Paul, I'm just going to let this be me in this movie. I'm going to let this part of me come out. And I think that physicality, maybe he added a lot more to that as well.
I know we're kind of discounting the parallel with L. Ron Hubbard, but Hubbard had made his real career as a great science fiction writer. I've got a lot of his early books. They're great, which might explain why Dianetic Scientology, whatever you call it, had a certain kind of appeal. It was an outre kind of thing. Now, that's nowhere here in this.
Well, we should measure that time travel is, though. Time travel is discussed, and some of them
are
ridiculous.
Along with everything else that's in the Mulligan's too?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, Suzanne, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and talk to Anika from Overland Park, who has a pet peeve. Anika, share what you feel is an annoying thing in a theater with us.
Well, the thing that I hate most about the theater is right before, you know, it always seems to happen, right before the main character makes the bad decision, which leads to the whole conflict of the movie, someone in the theater just shouts to the screen, "Don't do it!" in every single movie I go to.
There's a little too much audience feedback, huh?
Yes.
That'll be the horror film where the woman opens the forbidden door.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't go in there.
Yep, don't do it.
How would you address that problem? How would you keep people from shouting out like that?
Oh, I can think of
the solution.
Recognize that you're not sitting out.
Yeah, I hear you. A lot of people forget that.
Yeah,
I've actually been in a couple screenings. I guess there was one particularly about a year and a half ago where the people that were sitting next to me must have thought they were in their own living room. Exactly. And I am not a confrontational person, but when I'm watching movies, I'm trying to concentrate, and I had to get up and go tell them twice, you know, you're not at home. And you would think that the shame of that would cause them to stop. It's amazing when it doesn't.
On several occasions, I've seen a young married couple come in with a toddler, probably no more than 3 years old, into a really, really graphic horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, I'm ashamed to admit it, after the film ended, I walked down the aisle and I told them off. I accused them of child abuse. I was going to report them.
Wow.
I was so angry. They had no idea what to do. I may have scared the child more than them.
You know, Anika, I would suggest that when that happens, I would go ahead and talk to the person about it because, after all, it's worked for me.
Yeah.
And perhaps it will work for Eric. But I would say let the people know because a lot of times they're just not aware of it.
Right.
Thanks for your call, Anika. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
But do it quickly and make your exit before they hit you.
Yeah. Steve from Liberty wants to share a pet peeve. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I appreciate this. My biggest concern is that when people arrive late during the movie and sometimes they have to traipse over you to get to their seat or to a seat they want, and then that just interrupts your flow of trying to, as you say, focus on the film itself. And then the same thing, when the final climactic scene is ended, then everybody jumps up and run out when I personally enjoy sitting there and reading the credits and seeing sometimes where it was filmed and who was involved and so forth. This, to me, is accentuated more even in live theater and symphony and, say, the ballet, that people come in late. And then that's one thing, but then they come in late at the intermission. It's not just that they came late to the theater, but then they just lollygag out in the foyer and then come in late. They just, I don't know, they just disrupt others when they arrive in a late fashion or leave early. And, of course, Starlight is notoriously horrible for people getting up and leaving, even as the final production number is going on.
Well, taking it back to the movies really quick, I just want to say that anybody who shows up late to a movie these days, you might as well just not go because you're missing the film.
Sometimes 20 minutes opening before the film
exactly.
Even
there's 10 minutes of previews and 10 minutes of ads, and so you really must be out of your mind to show up late to a movie.
Exactly.
But seriously, the filmmaker wants you to see that opening scene, and there's games played on the internet where people will try to guess movies from the opening shot. If you miss the opening shot of a film, you're missing the film.
Right.
Now, I'm not going to argue about missing the credits, but if you're watching a Marvel superhero movie and you're not staying until the end, you're going to miss something. But
I want to track down the manufacturer who makes the popcorn and candy bags with an extra crackle potential. They rustle, rattle, and bang right behind me, and you hope, well, surely they'll finish the popcorn soon. okay.
Yeah, I understand that. And those people that are talking and texting during the movies, I mean, please leave your phone in the car. Give me a break. I want people to know that there are some theaters that are now starting to crack down on that. Probably the best example is the Alamo Drafthouse, which is making it their marketing effort to prove to people that they're not going to put up with talking and texting during the movies. And they've made some very funny PSAs and you know, that they show before the films to make that crystal clear that you're not expected to talk.
And many of them not safe for work and currently on the internet.
But they do have some screenings where that's encouraged.
Right. Right.
I went to a screening of Predator where the whole entertainment was from the audience, not from the screen.
Yeah, yep. Fair enough. Jeff on Twitter says a thing that really annoys him is kids running wild in R-rated films drives me insane. I totally agree. I saw a film one time. It was an action karate film with a lot of horrible violence mm-hmm. in it. And two little kids with their parents were there. And you think, okay, perhaps the parents know best what their kids can handle.
It's but child as
these
abuse.
These little children were leaving, one boy gave his brother a karate kick right in the lower back and was screaming and crying. I thought, well, there you go. What else do you expect? I want to touch base with Pam from Lee Summit, who wants to agree with John on a point. Pam?
Yes. Actually, two things. First of all, I did the same thing that John did. Somebody brought three small children to Hannibal, and I read them out and threatened to call the police.
Good for you.
So I did the same thing. And secondly, when I went to see Lawless, I was screaming at the film, get that son of a bitch, because I hate that guy, you know, the horrible guy in that movie, and I apologize to everyone who was in the theater.
Thanks for taking personal responsibility there. Thanks so much for your call,
guys.
Pam.
Thank you.
Well, I keep
Bye-bye.
Wondering about that couple. Every time they go to a movie now, they're going to wonder, is that weird guy here again?
Jeffrey in Topeka, you have a pet peeve. What is it?
Parents who let their children kick the back of the seats.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
That's sounds like the last airplane ride I took.
Exactly.
I turned around to the little child and I told him that I was sorry his parents had no manners and that they had never taught him not to kick the seats. They got up and left.
That works.
Well, you lucked out on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get punched in the face.
Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. How about Leslie from North Kansas City? Hi, Leslie.
Hi, great show as always. I was telling the screener it sounds like a little old lady complaint, but sometimes the volume level in certain movies, you know, it can rise and fall, and especially if there's not many people in the theater, it's just too loud.
Well,
and
previews.
Previews, yeah, and sometimes the movie, depending on what it is, like they'll have too much music going on. I mean, it's as if they want to throw everything at you, you know, sensory overload, and I'll often just go tell somebody up front, and a lot of times they will turn it down slightly. But, you know, it's just, it takes, you know, it's just, it's rattle, rattle, rattle. It's like we're already overloaded with things, you know, just media and everything at us. And, I mean, it's an old complaint, but having ads before the movie, I hate.
Leslie, you might be interested in knowing that we got an email from Willis, and Willis says, the thing that irritates me the most is the sound volume levels in most theaters.
Yeah.
It's a rare day when I don't feel like my long-term hearing is under assault. It honestly keeps me from going more often.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things. Now, I don't know. I spend part of the time in Texas nowadays with my family, and just a little hometown theater down there, they'll do almost anything you ask. I've not been to, you know, any movies recently up here, but it just takes away from the actual, you know, performance because, you know, you're too busy thinking about how loud it is. And if I could throw something real quick in, I know you've talked about the Philip Seymour Hoffman movie a lot, but I got in late. Did you mention that, I guess Joaquin Phoenix, you know, he grew up in something that some have referred to as a cult.
Yeah.
His family. I mean, they were hippies, but they also, I don't know if it was semi-religious, but, you know, that has been mentioned in a few articles, so I guess he was perfect for the role.
Perhaps brought a little personal background there. Huh?
Yes.
Thank you, Leslie.
Show.
Appreciate
Thank
your call.
You. Uh-huh.
Suzanne from South Kansas City has a pet peeve, and I think it's similar to what we've heard already, Suzanne.
I was just listening, and yes, it is very similar. It's when it's the previews or whatever the theater chooses to show before the movie. The it's always so loud. It's like it's just deafening. You can't. It's just too loud. It's very uncomfortable, and I don't see the need for that.
I think behind all this is the necessity of communicating with whoever you can find, if you can find somebody in charge. And these big megaplexes, that can be difficult. But in places like the Fine Arts and the Tivoli and all those, it's much easier to find somebody that you can register a complaint with.
That's true, and I should do that. But usually it's the young people at the ticket booth or it's the concession stand people, and I don't see anyone else. So,
Suzanne, did you also send us an email?
No, I didn't.
Okay,
no.
Then we got an email from another Suzanne about the master. We appreciate your call, Suzanne. And Suzanne, another Suzanne, writes
yes.
us, emailed and said, we bailed out on The Master after an hour and 45 minutes. The early part was incredibly slow. The plot was thin. Joaquin Phoenix was brilliant in his role, but also very dark. How could we, as viewers, muster any interest in his journey?
Well, I'll tell you what, it doesn't get any faster.
No.
So if you thought the first part was slow.
Yeah, the first half hour actually moves along.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what, I enjoy really deep, interesting character portraits of interesting people. And yes, he's not a very likable character. But for me, it was he was emblematic of the time period and maybe freakishly so on one end. But I was just fascinated by this character. And when you see somebody – like in Argo, all the characters are really one-dimensional. They just serve the purpose of the plot. They move it forward. It's suspenseful. But when you see a character that has so many different levels, for me, it's just fascinating to find out what makes them tick and take these little scenes and interpret them for yourself and blow up to a larger canvas. And I really think that's what The Master does. So that's why it was fascinating to me.
Do you mind if I just interject very quickly a reference to the movie that cleaned up last weekend, which is Taken 2? Now, I'm not here to valorize the film by any stretch, but it has a sequence in it that's my favorite maybe of the year. That's when Liam Neeson, who's in, where is he, Istanbul or something,
yeah.
He's knocking heads and being kicked around, and he's mixing it up trying to retrieve his wife and daughter, and he puts in a phone call for help to a CIA agent back in the States. It's a guy out on a golf course hanging out with a cell phone at his ear. Now think about what this says. Federal indifference, lounging around, delays, procrastination. And here's this agent on the scene mixing it up. And the contrast between those two characters at that moment, to me, typified not that film, but maybe the state of things right now in terms of politics and activist stances and how they don't seem to come together.
Gotcha. Let's quickly talk to Michelle from Independence, who has a pet peeve. Welcome aboard, Michelle.
Hi.
Wanted to talk about asking people not to talk during the movies?
Right, to be cautious about that as to who you talk to, because we had that happen to us, and the people threatened us
yep.
in the theater. Yeah.
Sometimes it's best to get the theater personnel involved when it gets bad.
Well, and we were going to do that, but it was that we thought they'd calm down, and then towards the end of the movie, they threatened us again, and so we just wanted to leave, you know, because it was at the end. So we left, and then they followed us out, and then
yeah.
they threatened us outside.
You know what?
Wow.
Anytime you have an unpleasant situation in the theater, whatever it is, if you're not satisfied with the theater experience, I encourage everyone to go to the theater management and say, whatever reason, I have had an unpleasant experience here in your theater, and this is it. Because they want to know. They want to make it good for everyone. And ask for your money back or ask them to give you some recompense in some way because you didn't have a positive experience.
Well, and let's hope if you do call the manager that he's not out on a golf course.
Most
theaters do have a security cop on the premises.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR, and you can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. Email us at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us at KCURCST. Let's jump back in and cover some of the movies that we hadn't had a chance to get to yet. One of them is End of Watch.
I loved End of Watch. What an immediately graphic, gripping movie and character study of these two cops, Jake Gyllenhaal and I think Michael Pena,
mm-hmm.
who steals the movie, by the way. He's a Mark Ruffalo lookalike, but he's got chops on his own, and you follow these two guys through a series of doors. There they are in South Central L.A., And every door they knock on reveals really bad things, whether it's parents who keep children tied up in the back room or whether it's evidence of a Mexican cartel, which will then overtake them with disastrous consequences. Fine film. I give it 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I really like this film, too. I'll give it a 3.5 out of 5. The thing that I'm counting it off on a little bit is that every single door was the most gruesome thing ever.
That's true.
So I love their friendship, though, and that's really the heart of this film.
Yeah. I didn't like it quite as well as you did, mainly because of the handheld camera work, which I think gets a really old after a while. You have to really be talented to pull that off. But how about 3.5 from the three of us for End of Watch? Is that acceptable to you guys?
Sure.
Okay, good. And let's also cover... Seven Psychopaths, which opens today.
Oh, man, this is a fun movie. I'm telling you, this Seven Psychopaths is a movie that's made for film lovers. If you think that you have seen all that there is to see in movie comedies, go see this film. This is directed by Martin McDonagh, the guy who did In Bruges, which was a surprise, kind of a revelation from a couple years back with Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson. This one stars Woody Harrelson as a psychopathic gangster who loves his Shih Tzu. The Shih Tzu gets kidnapped by Christopher Walken and Sam Rockwell, who are complete polar opposites.
There's a team.
Yeah, but so funny, and really the funniest team I've seen on film this year. These two guys really steal this film. But here's what makes it interesting is Colin Farrell is a screenwriter writing a movie called Seven Psychopaths. Why, you may ask? Well, because he knows that he has a goal. He has to come up with seven. He's only got one. And so the whole movie is it a movie? Is it not? What are these guys actually doing? And then it kind of takes this adaptation turn where the story that we're seeing kind of becomes like a movie. It's a satire of these kind of Tarantino-esque movies where people shoot guns and talk clever. But it's really smart. The ads don't make it look that smart. The ads make it look like it's one of those movies and that's it. But there's a lot more going on. It's very dark. Violent, yes, but in a satirical way and very funny.
And your rating out of 5?
4.5.
Yeah. Okay. Haven't seen it yet, but I tell you, it may be the big hit of the weekend from what I'm hearing.
We've had some people that have wanted us to comment about their pet peeves. Maureen on Twitter says, volume and lighting issues in the theater. Seems like each time I go to the theater, the volume is too high or too low. And Trish from Overland Park writes in that Amy Adams was the real master.
Absolutely.
In The Master.
And she's the Amanon's Grease, the power behind the throne.
I wanted to throw in a quick review of a movie that I think is very good, maybe the best documentary I've seen this year. It's called Searching for Sugar Man. And this is a really intriguing true story about a gentleman by the name of Rodriguez, who recorded a couple of unsuccessful albums in the 1970s, a rock, folk composer and singer. It was rumored that he had committed suicide, and his... bootleg tracks caught on for whatever reason in South Africa, of all places. And a couple of South Africans tried to find out what really happened to this singer-songwriter Rodriguez. And the movie chronicles their journey finding out the remarkable truth. And the truth really is remarkable. I don't want to give too much of it away, but it winds up being a very heartfelt, intriguing, and surprisingly moving story about this man's life. And so I highly recommend... Searching for Sugar Man, which actually is the name of one of Rodriguez's songs, and I'm giving it a 4. John, would you quickly tell us about Sinister?
Well, it's getting terrible reviews, justifiably so. I feel bad for Ethan Hawke, who's trapped inside a haunted house of his own, literally, I think, and figuratively here. But what is interesting to me about Sinister is that it's another movie that locates the horrors in the image. In this case, in VHS images from 8mm film. How many movies can we think of now? Was it The Ring, where the video, the television image would be your damnation? Something's going on here. We have a kind of a paranoia about the image. It's not scopophilia, but a scopophobia, where images have become the new horror. I mean, literally, the images that can suck your soul is what happens in Sinister. So you may or may not like the film, but it represents something going on in the course and trajectory of the horror film.
And your rating?
Oh, gosh, a 1 star.
I'll give it 2.
Kind of in the same boat.
So we'll average it out to a 1.5. How's that sound? For Sinister, rated R. We do want to try to get a couple of calls in before we hit the top of the hour. So Martin in downtown KC, welcome aboard.
Oh, hey, thank you. Yeah, everybody was talking about pet peeves. and I've learned how to handle my pet peeves. I go to about 4 movies a year, but I sleep through them. I found it to be the best $8 or $15 nap you can get. The only reason I go is because my kids and my wife want to go, but I was wondering, is it a pet peeve to other people to see someone taking a nap?
Only if they're snoring. If you snore, that's going to be an annoying thing for other people.
Yeah, well, I don't snore, but one time I did wake up with popcorn all around me, and I didn't remember buying any popcorn, so I know some people try to throw it in my mouth when I'm asleep. But I definitely get the best nap because of the sound system. I know people complain about it, but the sound system is set up so nice, the bass where it's at. And if anybody, you know, has too many pet peeves, just lean back, take a nap, and it'll be the best movie you've ever been to.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for your call. And, oh, did we lose Andrew? Andrew from
Andrew's
Topeka.
Still here.
Welcome aboard.
Greetings, greetings. My pet peeve is at the first level, people talking in the theater or women bringing their squalling brats. But my big pet peeve is when I went to complain about this, as you have suggested, I couldn't find any adult in charge of the theater.
There you go.
The manager, supposedly, was a young 20-something woman who had no authority, didn't want to exercise it, and didn't know quite what to do about the situation.
I know it's annoying, and we appreciate your call, Andrew. We're having to shut it down here. I just want to remind everybody that on Monday, Central Standard, this Monday, join Jabalani LaFall for a sports roundup with Greg Eshlin. And our show is produced by Tamika Witherspoon. Our announcer is Kim Noble. Thanks to my fellow movie critics today, Eric Moline, John Tibbetts. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard Friday. Enjoy your day.